good afternoon. Colleagues asked me this morning, are you expecting anyone? And I said, I'm kind of hoping for about somewhere between 30 and 50 people. And I think I counted 38, so not bad. Okay, I'm not sure whether I brought enough cookies. Maybe not quite, okay? They're homemade, I have to admit, not by myself. My wife cooked this. So if those of you who can still eat cookies at this time of the year, please take one each. And I hope we'll have enough for everyone. Oh, 40, 41, 42? Okay. Okay. Well, welcome to everyone here for the Christmas lecture. I'll try to... I won't make it very Christmassy, I have to say. The only thing that I can offer you at the end of the lecture is a little clip which I usually show at the end of the lecture before Christmas, which has nothing to do with Christmas, but which is, something about language, which I find very nice as a sort of way to finish the term. So... Not the finished term, finish the year. Okay, before we start with semantics, the usual few announcements, everyone should have noticed that the deadline for assignments to be submitted has now passed. If you haven't noticed, then you really need to do something about this. The results and answers will be communicated at the beginning of next year. You need to have done this in order to be allowed to take the exam, so if you haven't done it, then you ought to contact me as soon as possible and I'll try to find a solution, but the idea is obviously that this shouldn't necessarily happen. Okay? So, sorry, I couldn't do it for today. There was just simply too much to do. No way I could look at those, 150 or whatever it was. Okay, cookies are still going around. Yes, good. I'll also update the no lists over Christmas. Yeah? So you should be able to revise over Christmas if that's what you want to do. Good. Those were the announcements. Let's start with semantics. I've tried to add a few light touches to the lecture because it's the last this year, but you'll also get quite a few concepts that you'll need to learn or know how to use, and I'll try to differentiate between the two by letting you know what is important and what is not. Okay, what is semantics? Here's a sort of straightforward, easy definition, but in fact it's not as easy as that. I think you got used to the fact that when I start giving you a simple definition, then I usually make it more difficult afterwards. So, the study of meaning communicated through language. Okay? Now, as I said, it's not as easy as that, but let's start with a few things that are related to meaning. I found a recipe a while ago when I lived in the north of England. And that recipe, I'm not quite sure whether it was an American recipe or whether it was a British recipe. Doesn't really matter, but it's for Swiss cheese fondue. Okay. And it went as follows. We need 3 cups of shredded Gruyere or Swiss cheese, plus 2 cups shredded Emmentaler Gruyere, or Swiss cheese. And then we need all sorts of other things. Now, this is really funny. I mean, on the one hand, it's funny that the same cheese happens twice, That's not what I'm talking about. The point that I'm talking about here is, what is Swiss cheese? Okay. Now, those of you who are, like me, someone who has spent some time in Switzerland, knows what Swiss cheese is. It's the cheese produced in Switzerland. Yeah. But for the Americans and for the Brits, this is not the case. They think Swiss cheese is a particular type of cheese with holes, etc. It's something like Gruyere, it's on the same level as Gruyere or Emmentaler. So it's not a superordinate term. Yeah? Now this suggests that we have different ways of organizing the lexicon, different ways of organizing meaning in our brains, in our minds, depending on which culture we grew up in. Okay. I'll give you another example. Again, this is something to do with my life in the north of England. I don't know how much you've been exposed to British public transport, but they do occasionally run not quite on time. I guess like the Deutsche Bundesbahn today as well. And they publish things on their website. This was the local train line that I used quite often when I wanted to go to Manchester. And they publish things about their own performance. Okay? And they say that they are committed to being punctual. Okay? We are continuously measured on how well we perform. Okay? Now, we want our trains to be punctual, and punctuality is defined as the number of trains arriving within 10 minutes of the advertised time. So if a train is 10 minutes late, or 9 minutes and 55 seconds, it's on time. Now, before the north of England, I used to live in Switzerland. And then I came across this about 2 years ago. Pünktlichkeit, die SBB, that's the Swiss railway system, setzen die Latte höher. And it basically says, nicht mehr fünf, sondern nur noch 3 Minuten zu spät sein, in order to be counted as punctual. Okay. So quite clearly, being on time, being punctual, is culture specific, is country specific. Okay. A very long time ago, I had a South American girlfriend. Her idea of punctuality was also very different. That could well be, I don't know, an hour later, and that was still, it still felt for her as being on time. Yeah. So, quite clearly, there isn't a one-to-one relationship between a word like pünktlich or punctual and what it refers to, what it means. Okay. Now, the three words that are important in this context are meaning on the one hand, reference, and then I'll also be talking about sense. Now, in fact, meaning is an extremely difficult concept. There are whole books written about meaning. There is a book called The Meaning of Meaning. Okay. So I'm not in any way pretending that I'm going to give you the full picture here. I'm going to give you some of the basics that many people will agree on, but this is actually an area where philosophers disagree, where linguists disagree, etc. But I'm hoping to give you the basics. Okay. So it's clearly a difficult question. And I'd like to show you why it is difficult to start with. If we have a sentence like, the Prime Minister is in the car, I think we have very little trouble to find out what is meant. Okay. We can sort of picture a car and there is a person inside and that's the Prime Minister. And we have no problems with the meaning of the Prime Minister or the car. If we look at those two sentences, then things become a little bit more difficult. The Prime Minister can mean someone specific, okay, and that's the first of the three sentences, but look at David Cameron as the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister isn't really, I mean, it's more of a role, really, that we're talking about here. Okay. It is, of course, filled by a particular person, okay, but we can't really fully say that this, the Prime Minister, and this, the Prime Minister, 100% mean the same thing. And also, what does should mean? Should does in any case not mean something like the Prime Minister. It means something, but something different. Okay. More people joining. Okay, I'm surprised. You missed the cookies, so sorry.
Still one left.
Still one left. Okay, so let's first look at reference. If I say I was late because the computer crashed, then I'm referring to, for example, my computer. And I'm using what's known as the linguistic or a linguistic expression, namely the words the computer, to identify something which I can, for example, point to, the referent. Okay? So in other words, the two words here are a referring expression which I use to refer to something which in fact is now in front of me. But you could say the same thing, and in fact you would be referring to a different computer. Okay? So I'm using this referring expression. It's almost like an act, really. There is no reason why the computer means this thing here in front of me. It basically becomes the thing in front of me by my using the words the computer in this context where you can see it. So the computer could be a completely different computer. So referring expression is a term which is important, and as such, the referring expression doesn't mean anything in the sense of referring to something, but I can use it for that purpose. As a result of this, actually, we can refer to something which has no existence. Okay. We can refer to unicorns. We all know that they don't exist. Most people agree that Harry Potter doesn't exist. But clearly, we can refer to him, etc. So that's what I mean by saying that it's an act. Okay? We use words to refer to something that we can then agree on, I have referred to. The fact that real existence doesn't have any influence on the kind of language we use can be seen when we look at this little extract here. There was once an old man who lived in the forest. He, so the old man, lived all by himself and was very lonely. One day he met a frog near a pond. So we can introduce the referent, an old man, and we can refer to the referent by using a personal pronoun, he. We can do the same with an old elf, and we all know that elves don't exist. But we can use the same referring expression, he, even though it's clearly someone or something that doesn't exist. So reference is not linked to the existence in the world, but it's more linked to the kind of discourse world that we build up. I'm currently building up a discourse world with you. Okay. We can refer to things that wouldn't make sense to other people outside this lecture theater. There are different types of reference. If I have this sentence, and this is in fact a famous sentence in semantics, but I'm not using it for any further purpose. The cat is on the mat. Okay? You can imagine that I'm referring to a particular black cat which is sitting on a particular mat. Okay? If I utter the sentence, the sun is very hot today, okay, well, maybe not today, but the sun is very hot today, then what am I referring to? I'm referring to the sun, but of course there are many suns. There are millions of suns. And we all know, because of our shared experience of living on the same planet, that I'm referring to this particular sun in our planetary system. The sentence, the plumber we used to see at university turns out to be my next door neighbor, is something similar in some ways. I mean, there are many plumbers around. Okay. But the person that I'm currently talking to is a person that, together with me, has seen a person which turns out to be our neighbor, namely the plumber. Okay? So it's shared experience which makes it possible to use, well, to use what? To use definite reference. I'll show you that in a minute. This is different here. A man came in with a child. Okay? This is different from the way that referent is introduced. It's a referent that has not yet been introduced before. Okay. And that's why, in this case, we need to use indefinite reference first before we can then refer to the person with definite reference. Okay. So we introduce two new reference with a referring expression. Once that's been done, once it's part of our shared discourse, we then can refer to it with definite reference. So, shared experience of all sorts. living on the same planet, or going to the same university, or sitting in the same lecture theatre. Okay, that was the difference between definite and indefinite reference. There is another difference that I want to introduce. Straightforward sentence, this is a chair. I can refer to that. Okay. I'm going to IKEA next week to buy a chair. Notice that I use the indefinite article here. Does this chair exist? Does it have reference? Well, in a way, but not in the same way as this is a chair. Somewhere in IKEA, there will be a chair which I will buy, but it's not clear whether it's the one on the left hand or on the right hand somewhere in IKEA. Once I have it in front of me, it has got reference, definite reference. Okay. But if I just say I'm going to buy a chair, then it's not quite clear which one it is in particular. I may have a model in mind. What do we have here? Ken wants to marry a woman with blue eyes and grey hair. Do we know who it is? Well, maybe, because I say she is called Susie. So she has reference. Okay. But maybe it's just something that Ken has made up his mind about. I think I want to marry at some stage, and I don't really care what she's called, as long as she's got blue eyes and grey hair. Yeah? And she has to be younger than 40 years. So it's like the chair example. Yeah? It's a particular type of chair that I'm thinking of, but the actual reference is not yet there. It's not yet given. Okay. Now the difference here is not between definite and indefinite, but it's between specific and non-specific. If I say this is a chair, then we're talking about a specific reference, or using specific reference. But if I say I want to buy a chair, but that chair isn't yet, I mean, it's just somewhere that I haven't seen it yet, and I know the model, then it's a non-specific reference. Okay. Here's a little cartoon that makes use of that distinction. Okay. I believe there is one true soulmate for every person. Mm-hmm. He must be very busy. Okay. This relies on the difference between specific and non-specific reference. I meant one per person. Your way would be stupid. Yeah, can your soulmate be a monkey? Anyway, so this is the linguistic joke. Okay, so we've had indefinite versus definite and specific versus non-specific reference. There is a little aside that I want to introduce here, which goes back to the lecture that I gave a week ago. This is actually something that we might find in spoken language. Someone's telling about something that maybe happened last night. I walked into the dark room where the music was pumping. Then I saw this bloke. I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Scrubber." Okay. I don't know what scrubber is, but what am I talking about here? Then I saw this bloke. What's happening here? This is a person that the speaker hasn't mentioned before. This is a person that therefore has not yet, in the common discourse that we have, that the world of discourse that the speaker and the hearer have, been given a reference. So it's like the a man came in with a child. But we're using a referring expression which is in fact definite. Yeah, a demonstrative pronoun, this. This is odd. Okay. This is one of the features of spoken grammar. It sort of suggests that something might have a reference even though it hasn't got one yet. And it's something that you might also find in literary texts. Yeah. But this is only an aside. I don't want to confuse you. Typically, what I've said is true, that usually we first introduce new reference with an indefinite article. Okay, now there is in fact a third type of reference that I want to briefly introduce. The giraffe has a long neck.
Okay.
Now this could be spoken by, I don't know, family goes to the zoo and say, oh look, a giraffe. The giraffe has a long neck, and then it has reference, specific reference. Okay. But we could also be talking about giraffes in general. Okay. So, giraffes have long necks, we could say. Okay. Or, a giraffe has a long neck. Now this type of reference is called generic reference, because we're talking about giraffes in general. And we use this in contexts where we want to make, sort of, as it says here, timeless statements, law-like properties, etc. Dogs have four legs. Now, even if you see a dog with three legs only, it'll still be true that, generally speaking, dogs have four legs. Generic reference is actually quite interesting. We can say doctors are well paid. Can we say the doctor is well paid? A doctor is well paid? It seems to be possible with giraffes, okay, but not with doctors in this context. I have no response or no explanation for this, but it seems that not all generic, generic expressions can be used in all three constructions. Turtles lay eggs, right? Malaysians are good at badminton. And as I said, dogs have four legs. But if you think about it, how many turtles, what proportion of turtles do lay eggs? 50%? Only the females, right? Malaysians are good at badminton. I don't know. I don't know how many Malaysians are good at badminton. I don't know, maybe 1% or something like that. They usually, or they often win the world championship in badminton, but, I mean, not everyone. And dogs, 99.999% of all dogs have four legs. So we have half of all, very, very few, and virtually all. But we can still use generic reference to refer to this. This is odd. So quite clearly, meaning and reference, etc., there's a lot more than what I can say today. But clearly, reference is an important part of meaning. If I say, who is the woman over there, and then say, she's my sister, then they have the same reference, right? Quite clearly. But the woman over there and my sister clearly have different meaning, right? This can also be seen in a sentence like this. Bill Clinton is married to Hillary Rodham Clinton. Okay. The winner of the 1996 US presidential election is married to Hillary Rodham Clinton. We're describing the same fact in a way. Yeah? So sometimes you might hear the propositional content is the same. But Robin wanted to know if Bill Clinton was the winner of the 1996 US presidential election. Try substituting Bill Clinton for the winner of the 1996 US presidential election. What do you get? Robin wanted to know if Bill Clinton was Bill Clinton. So, there is a difference between reference and meaning. You can't just take reference as meaning. It's part of it, but it's not all of it. There are many jokes in this context, and here is a somewhat saucy one that actually makes this point very nicely. Okay? Also, there are many expressions that mean something, but that haven't got any, well, that simply don't refer, okay? And I gave you the example of the modal should already, but also something like the, okay? Like a determiner. It doesn't really refer as such. So there are parts of language which are outside this system, so to speak. A another nice way of explaining, or another nice way of showing that reference and meaning are actually different things, is to ask how logical language is. Let's look at maths. Everyone knows that if A is larger than X and A equals B, then B must be larger than X. Fine. Yeah? Language should really behave in the same way if language was logical. Okay. A while back there was a president in the United States, probably before you, well, no, you're not that young, but anyway, who had some problems knowing a lot of things, including geographical facts. The president thought that the city of Copenhagen was in Norway. The city of Copenhagen is the capital of Denmark. Therefore, the president thought the capital of Denmark was in Norway. So, it's the same as with the password example, really. Okay, let's step back one step further, I guess. And look at different types of meaning, because I introduced reference so far, but we can talk of different types of meaning, and only one of them is actual referential meaning. Okay. Here's a nice little definition for you. The person, object, abstract notion, event, or state to which a word or a sentence makes reference. Okay. So if I say the chair, then that has referential meaning as a thing with usually four legs and I can sit on it. But there are different types of meaning. Social meaning. By saying a particular word, or type of word, we may actually express more than the referential meaning. We have, they express certain characteristics of the speaker and the situation in which we speak it. Whether something is formal or informal, or they may say something about social class. Certain words may be associated with lower or higher social class. Okay. And this is really something that's not part of the referential meaning at all. It just basically is part of something on top, really. Okay. The second meaning that is on top is called affective meaning. And this is something that expresses aspects of speaker attitude, evaluation, whether someone said it in a sarcastic way, happiness, excitement, etc. I'll give you examples in a minute. The two meanings that I introduced apart from referential meaning together make up something that you perhaps have heard before as connotations. So these are associations that we have with individual words. So we have association or connotations, but referential meaning is denotation. Okay. Now, in Finnegan there is one exercise towards the end of the chapter which does exactly test this. If you look at the words hoax, trickery, swindle, rip-off, ruse, and stratagem, then you could look at issues of referential meaning, but you could also look at issues of affective meaning. Okay. Do they have different social and affective meaning? Okay, different connotations. So, for example, rip-off is much more informal than stratagem or hoax. Even though referentially, they pretty much mean the same thing. Yeah? So, we have many words in the English language. We know that, you know that English is a language with a huge vocabulary, and we have many words that refer to the same things, or can refer to the same things. But, they may differ on a level of association, like social or affective meaning. Actually, there is another meaning which I want to quickly introduce, and that's what some people call, it's about collocations. Okay? Collocated meaning, some people say. Do you know the difference between pretty and handsome? Well, it can combine with different words. And some people say that the fact that it can combine with only certain types of words is not actually, is actually part of the meaning of the word.
Okay.
Do you say pretty village or handsome village? Pretty village, yes. Do you say pretty woman or handsome woman? Who is in favor of pretty woman? Yes, okay. And who thinks that it's handsome woman? Okay. Very few. Okay. Yes, that's true. The normal collocation is pretty woman. Okay. Isn't there a film called Pretty Woman? Pretty color, handsome color? Pretty color. Mm-hmm. Pretty contribution or handsome contribution? It's a handsome contribution. It's a lot of money, for example. And it's a pretty garden, and it's a handsome inheritance. And is it pretty proportions or handsome proportions? Handsome proportions. Yeah? Well, we can check it out after the lecture. Pretty flower. Yeah? So it seems that pretty can connect to certain words, while it doesn't normally do with others. And that may, in fact, constitute a part of the meaning of the word pretty. Actually, some people who felt that a handsome woman was fine, yes, there are handsome women. Okay? There are handsome women. But, let's see. A fearsome if handsome woman. Or, what people call a handsome woman, a phrase which has always struck me as a bit patronizing. A handsome woman with a streak of sensuality. There are handsome women, but there seems to be something special about them. Yeah? They are either very tall women, they are somewhat older than pretty women, they are dangerous women, they are particularly sensuous women, or whatever. So it's some kind of marked way of referring to a woman. Yeah? The default is pretty woman. And handsome boy. Okay, now we've done reference. I'd like to say a few words about sense.
Okay.
Now this is the traditional way of looking at things. Sense really refers to a meaning that would be found in a dictionary. Yeah. And the idea is that we have this mental representation of it. Like if I say chair, then I think of a prototypical chair which has four legs and maybe a rest that I can put my back against.
Okay.
Now if we talk about sense, then we talk about something which is supposed to be invariant, which is always the same.
Okay.
So for Prime Minister, the example that we had before, we could, for example, come up with a definition, Chief Minister within the National Parliament.
Okay.
Now when we do those kind of things, looking at what the sense of a particular word is, then we're looking at a particular type of semantics, namely lexical semantics.
Mm-hmm.
And we can then, in fact, look at ways of comparing different senses. Okay? Or we can, for example, come up with ways of defining a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know what a woman is? The next example I'm going to give you is bad. I have to apologize beforehand. Please don't sue me. Okay. Can you think of what is the definition of a woman?
Okay.
Before we actually talk about how this might be defined, I would like to read you this little extract which I found in the newspaper and which is also circulating on the internet. There's trouble brewing, guys. You have to hope that this study is flawed, but the evidence seems irrefutable. Several months ago, scientists at Europe's annual human reproduction conference suggested that the results of a recent analysis revealed the presence of female hormones in beer, and suggested that men should take a look at their beer consumption. The theory is that drinking beer makes men turn into women. To test the theory, 100 men were each fed 6 pints of beer within a 1 hour period. It was then observed that 100% of the men gained weight, talked excessively without making sense, became overly emotional, couldn't drive, failed to think rationally, argued over nothing, had to sit down while urinating, couldn't perform sexually, and refused to apologize when wrong. Okay? No further testing is planned. Now, please don't get me wrong. This is not my definition of woman, yeah? But the point is basically that these seem to be additional meanings of the word woman, which some people associate with women, okay? And this, I think, makes the point quite nicely. It makes the point that it is actually not so easy to define what a particular sense is. Okay? Because what people have tried in the past is to look at groups of words like man, woman, boy, and girl, and come up with features that distinguish between them. In fact, there are some features that don't distinguish between them, like, well, they're all human, okay? But we can say that only the first two are adult, boy and girl are not, and male versus female. And that's a very convenient way to distinguish between the different senses. It becomes very difficult when you use this for abstract concepts, okay, freedom, etc. This is what was very popular in the 60s, I think, if I remember correctly. No one's believing that this is the way forward today, I think. I can very easily show you that this is problematic. For example, what is a girl? You can say the girl behind the counter at, I don't know, in some shop, and that girl might be 40 years or 50 years old. So you can't really say that you have particular features that make up the meaning or the sense of girl. What is a lady? Is a lady plus female, plus adult, and plus aristocratic? Well, maybe in the standard dictionary definition. But we nowadays talk about lady doctors, and we talk about cleaning ladies. And the cleaning lady is certainly not aristocratic. So it doesn't quite work as easily as that. Many of you are starting to become a bachelor or to, well, a bachelor of arts, or to get a degree. Okay. What is a bachelor, actually? Well, easy. Unmarried, adult, male. Well, maybe not when we talk about getting a degree, then we allow female students to become bachelors as well, but that's sort of the original meaning of bachelor. So, does the Pope qualify? He is unmarried, he is adult, he's male, but would it really make sense to call him a bachelor? Is Tarzan a bachelor? So it seems that there are additional elements, like in the woman and drinking beer example, that, well, not quite like, but in a similar way, that come into the meaning of words. Okay. So in this case, age, eligibility, freedom to marry, the Pope cannot marry or will not marry, okay, or lifestyle, etc., might come into the picture. So it's more complex than what can be covered with the semantic feature analysis. The philosopher Wittgenstein looked at things like that in a bit more detail, and he wanted to come up with a definition of game. What is a game? Think about what characteristics a game might have. Just think about one or two games and see whether they have everything whether you can find something which all of them have in common. Okay, I've got two longish quotes for you. Consider the proceedings that we call games. I mean board games, card games, ball games, Olympic games, and so on. What is common to them all? Don't say there must be something in common, or they would not be called games. But look and see whether there is anything common to all. Okay, here's the longish quote, but we can do this very quickly. Tennis and jacks, you probably don't know jacks, it's a kind of game, have a ball in common. There's no ball in hopscotch, but there are jacks. There are no jacks in jump rope, but there is hopping. Leapfrog is a child's play, but there's no equipment, no balls, jacks, or rope. In volleyball, there are no rackets, but there is a ball and a net. Badminton has no ball, but there are rackets and a net. There is no net in bridge and playing cards and tennis, no playing cards and tennis, but bridge and doubles tennis are played by teams. There are no teams in solitaire or patience, but there are playing cards. There are no cards in chess, but an individual may play chess against himself. Jacks is not played with a dog, but fetch is sometimes played with a ball. There's no winning or losing in fetch, but there is exercise in it for the dog. Yeah. So, this is a long way of saying, here's his own summary. I can think of no better way or no better expression to characterize these similarities, these similarities as family resemblances. And I shall say, games form a family. And in fact, there isn't a feature that is necessary for all of them, but there are some features that are shared and others that are not. And in fact, there are more prototypical games than others. For example, playing fetch with your dog is perhaps not a prototypical game, while something which has, dice and figures that you have on a sort of board, then that's a very prototypical game. Now, I've already twice used the word prototypical because that then led to prototype theory. This is typically shown with something like this. What is a bird? Well, there are more prototypical birds than others. An ostrich is not a prototypical bird, but it's counted among the birds. It can't fly. Okay? Penguin is also not a prototypical bird. A robin is the most prototypical bird for the English-speaking native speaker. While there are others that are sort of further out, which are closer to the robin as a prototype, but which are in fact not quite as prototypical. So this allows for much more graded ways of looking at meaning. We can say, yeah, it's just about a bird, but there is something non-birdy about it. But that's fine, because it still is sort of a remote or relative of the prototype. Okay, now, in fact, this also has to do with the way we conceptualize things. And these are not categories which are very clear-cut. The category of bird, we see has many, it's more or less bird-like rather than bird or not. Okay. Wierzbicka, Polish linguist, I think she lives in the States nowadays, says, language doesn't reflect the world directly. It reflects human conceptualization, human interpretation of the world. It's not that the birds have something in common by sort of nature. We put them together as a family in our brains, so to speak. Okay. And these, in fact, can change over time, and I'll come back to that in a minute. One way to show that language and the form of language and the way we conceptualize things are have something in common is to look at something which you know very well, the difference between count and mass nouns. We can talk about cow, one cow, and several cows. We can count them. We can talk about petrol, but we don't say two petrols. Why is that? Well, because a cow is clearly delimited, and petrol isn't. We can't take half a petrol and then only have half a petrol. It's still petrol. So it's not something that has shape and a precise limit. So it seems to be that the language and the grammatical structure of words, or the morphological structure of words, is a reflection of its meaning, so to speak. In some way, it reflects what it can refer to. Of course, there's always a but. Okay, Betty likes to gorge herself on cake, or cookies, on cake. Is cake countable? Well, in this case, it isn't. Yeah? Cake is some kind of mass noun. But of course, we can say in English, whenever Betty gobbles down a cake, her diet starts tomorrow. So in fact, some words can actually like transcend the boundaries of count versus non-count words. Okay, I'll add something to this fact that it's actually a conceptualization of reality, in the sense as if vocabulary seems to slice up the world. Okay. This is quite interesting to look at different languages. Are there any speakers of Russian in the room? Okay, so maybe, because I'm not entirely sure about this. We have to see it. Okay. Can you count strawberries in English? Yeah, you can say one strawberry, two strawberry. You can do that in German. Yeah. But in Russian, do you say one, what is it, одна клубника? Can you do that? Одна?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Because someone once told me that this was not possible, that klubnika would only be sort of considered like a mass. Okay, yeah, I kind of experienced it. I showed this example in the last year in the lecture, and someone was complaining, so I had actually made a mental note to check this. Let's see whether we can agree on the next one. This one I actually find difficult for the German examples too. We can't count furniture. But we can sort of say just about, I'm not 100% native speaker of German myself, I feel, but ein Möbel, zwei Möbel, drei Möbel? Yeah? Yeah, yes, I think that's possible. But you can't say, what is it, ein Möbel? Huh? You can say one or two or three? No, you can't. Okay. So it seems that different languages have different conceptualizations. I think there is, what was it? I can't remember, but I think it was something like garlic in some countries you can, or in some languages you can count garlic, in others you can't. And some people have tried to link this up with the way garlic is used in their cuisine. I don't know. Yeah. So there seems to be culture-specific ways of dealing with this. One Russian thing that I'm sure about is that you have a different number of basic colors. Okay. Whereas in English, we say blue. Okay. There are two terms in Russian which cover parts of what we call blue. You either have синий, which means dark blue, or голубой, which means light blue. Right? Yes. Okay. So the number of basic terms is different. And it means that the reality, the reality of experience, is split up differently in different languages. Okay, talking about splitting up things in your mind and ordering things, here is a wonderful little thing that daughter of a colleague I used to work with in Britain said. When I grow up, I'm going to be an adult or a teacher. Or a princess, or a cooker. Okay, she probably meant cook, but anyway, so the morphological rules aren't quite there yet either. Yeah. Now, what does this suggest? This suggests that these are concepts which are all on the same level of hierarchy. Yeah. So being an adult has the same kind of value for that girl as being a princess, or a cook, or a teacher. While we would order things differently, we would put adults perhaps on a higher level, on a superordinate level. Okay, you can be a child princess, but adult is a more general term. So it seems to be that children need to learn the relationship between senses. And that leads me to the introduction of a few terms, which I'm afraid you'll have to learn. Okay. Hyponymy or taxonomy. Okay. I'm sure you've heard taxonomy before. Okay. This is basically the hierarchical ordering of senses or of lexical items with respect to each other. So a plant is the superordinate term. I could have put this upside down or sort of 90 degrees and then it would almost look like a syntax tree. Okay. So plant is the superordinate term. And flowers and trees are both plants, but there are different types of flowers, roses, tulips, and daffodils. So it's a hierarchical ordering, and it's a kind of relationship. So A rose is a kind of flower, and a flower is a kind of plant.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's always a but. What's a whale? Is it a kind of fish? Well, we know that whales are not fish. Okay, they're mammals. But most people, or many people, actually think that they're fish. So this is some kind of folk taxonomy. But, yeah. I guess that doesn't really contradict what I've said. So we've got the kind of relationship, taxonomy. We also have meronymy, which is something slightly different, but pretty much related in many ways. We can have the word body, and the body can have a trunk and an arm. And in fact, the arm can be divided into upper arm, forearm, hand, etc. So same principle, but it's not kind of, it's a part of. Yeah? It's also got to do with ordering the mental lexicon. And we know about relationships between different words. Synonymy, yeah, that's basic. Okay. Identity and meaning. So, couch and sofa. Stubborn, obstinate. Now, this goes back now to, or this allows me to go back to the point that I made about words having the same reference, but not, or the same referential meaning, but not necessarily the same associative meanings. Okay. For example, obstinate is much more formal than stubborn. So true synonymy is really very, very rare. Some people say it doesn't exist at all. Why? Well, it doesn't make sense. It wouldn't be economical. Language doesn't need two words for exactly the same thing. People are lazy. People want to have one word for one particular meaning. Now, the opposite of synonymy is antonymy. Okay, it means the opposite meaning. And this is something that we typically see among adjectives. Good or bad. True or false, young or old. And then, actually, this is not with adjectives, buy and sell. In a way, you can see that these are opposites of sorts. Okay. Now, with the adjectives, we can distinguish between non-gradable. Okay. Something is either true or it's false. Well, yes, in reality, it can be half true. Yeah. But we're talking about the basic idea here. But you can be older or younger. So we're talking about gradable antonyms here. And in the context of buying and selling, these are called converses, because if you buy something from someone, they will sell it to you. Again, there is more to it, and I can only touch the surface. In a pair of gradable antonyms, we usually have one of them, which is the unmarked choice. You ask, how expensive is the book? You don't ask, how cheap is this book? You only ask, how cheap is this book, if you're going to a particularly cheap place and you want to see whether it's the cheapest book in the bookshop, for example. How fast did she run? How slowly did she run? No, obviously you say, how fast did she run? Because the idea of running is, well, to be fast. Okay. Again, it seems to be something to do with the way we structure senses in our mind. So it's not just opposites, but some are preferred over the other. Okay. Another term you'll need to learn is homographs. Okay. I will lead you to the lead mine. Okay. What do we have here? We have two words that are spelled exactly in the same way, but they sound different. Mm-hmm. We have something similar, but reversed here. She met the knight in the middle of the night. Okay. Same pronunciation, different spelling. And in fact, we can have both, and that's really the most important category. We can have homonyms. I never lie when I lie in bed. Okay. Same spelling, same pronunciation. Same word? No, not the same word. It's, of course, a different word. It would be a different dictionary entry, but they sound and look exactly the same. Do they have anything to do with each other? No. I think that's the last term that will be new for you. Polysemy. Semantics, the study of meaning. The sem here is part of the same, well, it's the same root as in semantics, and poly, of course, means many. What is a lock? Well, you can have a lock in a door. And those of you who have been on a houseboat in Ireland or in France or whatever know that there are many locks, and in fact, of course, have taken the boat up to Saarborg, right? You pass two locks. So you can have a lock in a river. Same spelling, same pronunciation as up here with I never lie when I lie in bed. Yet there is a difference in the sense that this lock and this lock have something in common. They are related. They are conceptually related. Why? Well, both of them lock something up. Both of them stop something from going through. In the case of the door lock, the lock in the door, it's person, let's say a person going through. In the case of the river lock, it's water going through. Okay? And in fact, for boats, it's more difficult than when there is no lock. Okay? We also have a hair lock. Okay? Some of you have hair locks. Okay? Now that's a completely unrelated word. That is a homonym. So we have two words which are conceptually related, sound alike, look alike, and they are, we're calling, well, this is a case of polysemy. But we have a third word which has nothing to do with them, and therefore it's homonymy. This here plays on the concept of homonymy. Fine for parking here. Okay? It's not the best job, but anyway. Now, how can you determine whether it's a homonym or it's a case of polysemy? Well, you can't really. You need to know the history of the word. If the word is related in terms of the history of the word, then it is a case of polysemy. And this is often not immediately obvious to speakers of present-day English. So, if, for example, in an exam you were asked to describe the relationship between two words, and you're not quite sure about the history of the word, the thing to say is, I'm assuming that these are unrelated concepts, unrelated words, and therefore they are homonyms. Right. Sorry. Okay, last two concepts I want to introduce, but they won't be new for you, I hope, or I guess. Metaphor. He closed the hole with a board. What's that? That's a literal board. It's a piece of wood that you put in front of a hole. But of course we have expressions like chairman of the board, and this is not a literal board. It is related. You can sort of imagine that they first sat around a table, which is a board, of course. And you can see how they're conceptually related, but nowadays, chairman of the board is a metaphor. He paid for room and board. The bed, as in a plank of wood, I guess, that people used to sleep on. Nowadays, it's much more comfortable. In fact, boarding school comes from that. So the meaning is extended. And that's actually one way for the English language to have expanded the meaning of words a lot. Well, if I introduce metaphor, then the other term is not far behind, metonymy. Rome has decreed that celibacy will be abolished. Okay, unlikely, but okay. It's Rome. Well, who is Rome? It's not the city of Rome, but it's probably... Well, it's probably in the Vatican, so this is some... We could also have said the Pope has decreed. Okay? Or the crown wants all my money. It's not actually the crown, but it's the person wearing the crown. Okay? So, because in a way they almost touch, right? They are very close to each other. This is a difficult word. By the contiguity or association between the two references. And metaphor works on the basis of similarity. Okay, I'm almost done, not quite yet. I'm going to let you off a little bit earlier as a Christmas present. Yeah, right. Okay. Not yet. Okay, no, you still have to bear with me a few slides. Because one thing, I mean, I'm also the historical linguist here in the department. Not the only one, but I'm supposed to be looking at the history of the language as well. And one interesting case is also to look at how meanings have changed. Okay. Every time I say that that we're finished soon, people start sort of chatting and getting ready to go. Not quite yet, okay? There are types of linguistic change which are very regular. Okay. And this would be a lecture course on its own. But semantic change is said to be, in many ways, much more irregular. And of course, it's got to do with the society that we live in, particularly since I said that it has to do with the way we conceptualize the world. Okay. So new social realities, for example, can result in new meanings of words. I'll give you an example in a minute. So in some way it's not quite arbitrary, but it may seem sometimes arbitrary. What's the meaning of video? Well, a video is a noun in this case. Okay, you can also use it as to video with conversion. Was first used with the advent of television in the 1930s to refer to what was displayed on a television screen. That's obviously not the meaning today. It then was used for a video recorder, which was developed in the 1950s, and later it was most frequently used for the videotape cassette, which was popularized in the 1980s, and you probably have never used the video cassette, right? Oh, you have? Okay. And in fact, nowadays, you probably refer to video more as some kind of music video, which you download from YouTube or watch on MTV, right? So, clearly, it's expanded, it's changed its meaning. And this change can happen in various ways. It can, for example, become more specialized, more restricted. There is a very good example in the word to starve. To starve originally meant to die in any way possible. Okay? You can probably see how sterben and starve are related. It's very close. It goes back to the same word. But nowadays, starve means to die of hunger, so it's become more specialized. Meat, originally, meant any type of food, and nowadays it's the meat from animals, that we use as food. The flesh, animal flesh. Okay. So that's specialization. In fact, the opposite is possible too. The word arrive, you probably don't know, once you think about it, it makes sense. It originally was much more specialized. It was much more restricted. Arrive, come to shore. Okay, arrivare. Okay, so river is in there, I guess. Well, the word that led to the word river in English. Well, nowadays it's very general. Batch used to be a quantity of bread baked at once. Okay, nowadays I can talk about you as a batch of students, because you're all, in a way, well, I'm dealing with you at the same time, in the sense that you're in this more or less in the same semester, okay, or most of you. So, generalization or specialization, two ways in which semantic change can happen. It can also happen in the sense of becoming, well, better or worse in the context, or more positive or negative. A famous example here is the word silly. The word silly is actually related to the word selig. Okay. So it originally meant blessed, but nowadays it means, well, being silly. Okay. Clearly this is more negative. And a villain used to be someone, well, originally a low-born, base-minded rustic. Okay, this is not extremely positive, but it's also not very negative. Nowadays, a villain is something or somebody quite negative. Okay. Just in the case of specialization and generalization, we have the other way around here as well, amelioration. What is a knight? Well, a knight was actually pronounced Knecht in the Middle Ages and is therefore related to the word, the German word Knecht. It's a boy, a youth, a lad, a servant. Okay. Nowadays, a knight is of course something much more positive. And while sophisticated originally meant something rather bad, namely being artificial, nowadays it means to be cultured. Okay. Pretty is another example. It originally had rather negative connotations. So I'm not talking about the about denotation here, I'm talking about connotation. Yeah? Pretty meant cunning, crafty, artful, astute. Nowadays it means good-looking. Okay, final point to make this a little bit more theoretical. Okay, I've given you lots of examples. I've described what has happened. This is one way of doing things. The more advanced or the more difficult, and I think also the more interesting question is, why does it happen? Why do things change in some ways? And I'd like to just give you a little glimpse of this by looking at some changes that are also semantic changes in some way. And it relies on the fact that communication, of course, I mean nowadays, not nowadays, when I talk to you it's a very sort of one-way thing. But of course communication is typically a two-way and sort of process. Yeah? And if I tell you something, then I'm trying to make sense in the sense that I'm trying to formulate things in such a way that you understand what's going on, that you understand me. But you may sometimes need to interpret things a little bit, or maybe you don't mean exactly 100%, you don't understand 100% what I say, but make sense of it. And one of the ways that language can change is that this negotiation of meaning over repeated use, again and again and again, might actually result in change in meaning. Let me give you an example. What is the meaning of since? Since the first term, students have been doing even better. What does since mean? It's a temporal relationship. Yeah? There was a first term, students did quite well, and now we're in the fifth term and they're doing better. So, temporal relationship. Since students have to do exams, they work even harder. This is not really temporal. This is because. This is causal. Because there are exams, students have to work harder. There is little, if any, temporal aspect in here. Now, which one is the older? The temporal one? As in the first one, since the first term, or the second one, since students have to do exams. We have temporal or causal meanings. Which one is the earlier one? Well, think about it. Since she has left him, he has been feeling miserable. Is this temporal or is this causal? Well, both. Yeah? Now, it's probably more likely that that you read this as because he's left him, she's left him. But really, on one level, it is ambiguous. Now, originally, it was purely temporal. Since meant, well, since then. Okay? But because time has to do, well, we interpret things that happen as one having to do with the other. We see a reason for things to happen over time. And because of repeated uses in contexts like this, where perhaps the speaker only meant this to mean time, but of course there is a connection between her leaving him and him feeling miserable, since has gradually acquired the meaning of because. And that's because speakers and hearers negotiate meaning, and new meanings develop through renegotiation. So, language in use changes language structure, because since nowadays, of course, is not just it's almost like it's a conjunction. Okay, so it's a grammatical meaning. Okay. That was sort of a final point that I wanted to make to extend what I said about semantic change in general. Most aspects of semantic change are in fact much less regular. Now, don't pack up yet, because you get the clip that I want to show you at the end. Next lecture, I'm going to talk about text linguistics, okay, information structure, and what the Americans call pragmatics. So the organization of text, of sentences in whole texts. Okay. Right, which leads me to the end of the lecture, where I would like you to watch a short clip by people that you might know. As I said, it has nothing to do with Christmas. I couldn't find anything that was both suitably linguistic and suitably funny. I find this funny. It's the best I can do. Enjoy this as a sort of a little Christmas gift at the end. It is very relevant in the context of many aspects that we're talking about in this lecture. Okay.
So let's talk instead about flexibility of language, linguistic elasticity of language. Yes, I think I should tell you that our language, English, as spoken by us, as you think, it certainly defines it. We are defined by our language, if you will. Hello, we're talking about language. Perhaps I can illustrate my point. Let me at least try. Here's a question. So my question is this. Is our language, English, capable? Is English capable of sustaining demagoguery?
Demagoguery?
Demagoguery.
And by demagoguery you mean?
By demagoguery I mean demagoguery.
I also.
Highly charged oratory, persuasive, whipping up rhetoric. Listen to me. If we had been British, would we, under similar circumstances, have been moved, charged up, fired up by anti-inflammatory speeches, or would we simply have laughed? Is English too ironic to sustain Hitlerian styles? Would it have to be run false in our ears?
We're talking about things
which are false in our ears. May I compartmentalise? I hate you, but may I? Is our language a function of our British cynicism, tolerance, resistance to false emotion, humour, and so on? Or do those qualities come extrinsically from the language itself? It's chicken and egg problem.
We're talking about chickens, or we're talking about eggs.
Now, let me start deliberate here. There's language, and there's speech. There's chess, and there's a game of chess. Well, it's only market, please.
We've got chess.
In 18 piano keyboard, 88 keys, only 88, and yet hundreds of new melodies, new tunes, new harmonies are being composed on hundreds of different keyboards every day in Dorset and London. Our language, Tiger, our language, hundreds of thousands of available words, brilliant of legitimate new ideas, so that I can say the following sentence and be utterly sure that nobody has ever said it before in the history of human communication. Hold the newsreader's nose squarely, waiter, or friendly milk will come to mind my trousers. Perfectly ordinary words, but never before put in that precise order. A unique child delivered to a unique mother. We all of us spend all our days saying to each other the same things time after weary time. I love you, don't go in there, get out, you have no right to say that. Stop it, why should I? That hurt, help, Marjorie is dead. Surely it's a thought to take after a green tea or a rain Sunday afternoon.
So you might be more just means communication.
Oh, of course it is. I'm my mother, my father, my husband, my brother, my sister, my whore, my my mistress, my checkout girl, language is a complimentary moisture incentive cleansing square. Language is the breath of God. Language is the dew on a fresh apple. It's the soft rain of dust that falls into a shaft of morning light as you pluck from an old bookshelf a half-forgotten book of erotic memoirs. Language is the creak on the stair. It's a stuffy match held to a frosted pane. It's a half-remembered childhood birthday party. It's the warm, wet, trusting touch of a leaking napkin. The hulk of a child panzer. The underside of a granite boulder. The first downy growth on the upper lip of the Mediterranean. It's cobwebs long since overrun by an old Remington boot. Bye-bye.
Okay. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.